In Tynwald this week, the Treasury Minister presented the Isle of Man government's tax strategy not for approval but merely to be received, and even that modest objective came close to being derailed by an amendment from David Ashford MHK. Later in the programme we'll hear why Tynwald members didn't think that it was necessary for international standards to be applied to the size of their Keys constituencies. But first, we hear from several disgruntled Tynwald members who had hoped for much more in the tax strategy. First up, Speaker of the House of Keys, Ewan Watterson.
Like the budget, the tax strategy is important and will have multi-year implications, and I therefore really hope that options will be explored in conjunction with Tynwald members, with unions, with businesses and the wider community. In some detail, as they're developed and formulated rather than being kept as the preserve of council ministers. A general agreement on the principles and way forward regarding tax is going to be essential in terms of providing the stability that businesses and the community need going forward from this administration into the next. So the widest possible consensus within Tynwald and outside should be sought. This tax strategy needs to go hand in hand with other pieces of work, though. We have seen a cost improvement programme embedded into the Manx Care mandate, even if at the moment it feels like a cashback scheme. This needs rolling out across larger parts of government. There has not, however, been a considered view on the scope of government and things that we may have to stop doing or do differently, where technology can change the way we do it, or where, frankly, the technology that we deploy is hindering the delivery of the service. My belief is that this tax strategy is only going to hold credibility if government can look within itself at savings as well. The user pays principle has also been deployed erratically around government, and a coherent policy has long been needed around which services the government provides and how they should be paid for and by whom. Again, some consistency is required. This strategy also needs to align with government's wider goals. This government has set a population growth target, and this tax strategy aspires to increase public finances by £200 million by 2032. Now, it's not clear if the ambition on that page one, means income tax or includes VAT as well, but that's a significant increase in the average tax take for a new resident. So the logical conclusion from that is that the overwhelming majority of the new jobs that we are going to be seeking are going to be very high value added and very high earning. I suppose what I'd really like to see, Mr. President, is a vision for our economy and for our public service in 2032. I don't think the tax strategy provides that in isolation. I don't think the Ireland Plan provides that in isolation. I don't think the medium term, they're just not joined up, Echoen. So I would like to know what that does look like. How many people will be employed by government to serve a population of 100,000 people? What will the staff numbers be in health, in education, other service? What does that target operating model look like? How will the growth in the private sector balance the growth in the public sector? What will our finances look like if the government achieves its targets, whether that's at today's prices or 2032 prices? That's still a really useful piece of work that needs to be done in order to make sure that their planning comes together as a coherent whole. The key performance indicators and metrics on page 8 of this document are not just woeful but laughable, and I hope as the strategy matures, as the data comes forward, as the consensus is built around that target operating model for the shape and scope of our government over the next 10 to 15 years, we can have something far more meaningful in terms of measuring progress towards delivering that vision and model that I've just advocated for. I'm sure also that a comparative analysis of some of our tax initiatives compared to our neighbouring jurisdictions and close competitors would also yield valuable insight and should be shared as part of that research that underpins a tax strategy. Honourable members will not be surprised to know that I have a couple of spreadsheets and some back-of-fag-packet calculations that I think would be useful when we talk about tax. But as a mercy to you all now, and in the hope of broader engagement over the coming months, I will resist the temptation to bombard you with my economic analysis, but look forward to bouncing these ideas around and build that consensus, which a long-term consensus, which our island so sorely needs at the moment. Thank you, Echoen.
During the debate, Joni Farragher MHK was even more forceful in her comments.
To summarise the document, the existing 0-10 tax policy is being maintained and capital and wealth taxes aren't coming in. The health levy will be looked into. A tax rate of 20% will be imposed upon any petroleum extraction. Out of these, the only new piece of information for us is that capital and wealth taxes aren't being introduced over this administration. Why? We continue to tax a narrow band of people rather than broadening out taxation across society to make it more equitable. In other words, we're taxing workers and workers alone. If you earn your income by labour, you get taxed. If you live off dividends and don't work, then you aren't subject to any taxes during this administration. And there's a fundamental tension here that this document skates awkwardly around. Because whilst Treasury state that they won't introduce new taxes on capital or wealth, effectively shutting down that potential to broaden the tax base, they then go on to say they'll investigate potential opportunities to broaden the tax base. Well, which is it? Either you've already made your mind up, or you're going to investigate potential opportunities. What a massive shame to have already closed off these avenues, because frankly, workers are taxed enough. Yet this document seems to focus entirely upon taxing people who work rather than taxing people who have income. And what's more, that isn't equitable or progressive in any way, and nor is it sustainable and diversified, to coin some of the buzzwords that appear in this document. Treasury have set themselves a task there that's going to be pretty difficult, considering that they've also closed down the biggest part of the solution. Perhaps Treasury just really like a challenge. Or perhaps there is a deliberate policy decision in here that only workers should be taxed. And if so, actually we'll just waste time and resource investigating how to do something that Treasury don't really want to do. In the extensive report that KPMG did for government, paid for by the taxpayer, there's actually a really clear policy direction for taxation. It clearly says in that document that government tax strategy should significantly increase personal allowances to increase take-home pay for those on lower to middle incomes and seek to offset at least part of the cost of doing this by tapering away personal allowances and other reliefs for those on higher incomes. The KPMG report and the future economic strategy that came from it focuses upon addressing inequality using the tax system because, as it notes, their evidence very clearly shows that low to middle earners are not well served by our tax structure. And that not only is this inequitable, but it also runs counter to the objective of balancing the island's age profile. Yet this strategy doesn't do anything, not one single thing, to address this. It's just business as usual, status quo maintained, despite all the evidence that KPMG detailed and against their recommendation to the government on this. I mean, what are we actually doing here? Why pay a company £1 million to undertake extensive research on what will work to future-proof our island, only to roundly ignore it? I think the hard-pressed working people of the island would frankly prefer you just skip the part where we pay the million, if you're just going to do whatever you fancy anyway. Ectorin, I always try really hard to find positives, but I'm struggling here. For 2 years, every question I've asked around taxation has been met with the response that the taxation strategy is coming. All will be answered, but this document raises more questions than it answers. How will we meet our population aspirations without adjusting the unfair burden on low to middle taxpayers? Why are we ignoring the wealth of evidence and the recommendations of the KPMG report that we paid for? Will we be increasing personal allowance thresholds? How will we make the taxation structure more equitable and sustainable without broadening the tax base? Why should workers take such a big burden? Why shouldn't everyone with income be subject to tax? What I was expecting to see from this document was information about increases to personal allowance, a clear policy direction that the healthcare levy should be fairly and progressively applied rather than yet another burden for the low to middle worker, a commitment to implement the recommendations of the KPMG report, to tax income rather than work, to tax wealth, and to open-mindedly explore how to broaden the tax base to take some of the burden off low to middle income working people. I would also have loved to see some movement on making national insurance payable on all income rather than only up to age 65, although broadening the current national insurance holiday scheme for young people, and an indication of willingness to increase the proposed taxation on petroleum extraction. As a bare minimum, and in the absence of an actual strategy, I would have liked to have seen it clearly defined what is meant by being economically competitive and what exactly that brings to our island in comparison to what the benefits might be if we pivoted away from that model and pursued equitability and progressive taxation. Because all policy should be evidence-based, and that should start with taxation. This document states we'll be continuing doing pretty much exactly what we've been doing, and I would ask the Treasury and all honourable members, is that working then? What evidence have we seen to show us that this is the best policy for our island? What do we see around us to show us that we should carry on as is? Are we receiving enough in revenue to cover public services? Are we balancing our population effectively? Do people feel supported to grow their families here? And are we attracting people to our lovely island? Are we making people feel valued and that their earnings are taxed fairly and that that tax is being used effectively? I believe it was Albert Einstein who said that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. The motion in front of us asks us to receive this strategy rather than approve it. I do feel bound to say for the record that I couldn't approve or support this document.
Hot on Joni Faniger's heels came Claire Christian, who was keen to join the fray.
KPMG was commissioned to provide this government with an economic strategy, our big picture. Advice which cost the taxpayer somewhere between, I understand, £1.5 million and £2 million, which included further phased reports all available on the government website. I'm particularly going to focus on the document entitled Our Big Picture Strategic Economic Framework Phase 3. This document contained some tax strategies for the Isle of Man government to consider. But for your reference, there's a section called Review of the Tax Structure, Individual Tax, on page 71. Members, to save you looking for this document, let me summarise their assertions. KPMG review highlights the challenges the island faces in attracting and retaining young economically active individuals due to the tax system not offering significant advantages compared to the UK. And I quote, the island's tax system only offers marginal advantages compared to the UK when taking into account the higher cost of living on the island. Some households will be financially worse off than in the UK. As a large and near neighbour, the UK has historically been the most significant source of inward migration to the island and a common destination for outward migration, and hence it is a relevant comparator. And so, KPMG go on to suggest revising the tax system by increasing the personal allowance for lower to middle income residents, making living on the Isle of Man more financially attractive. And I quote again, it is suggested that the government considers revising the personal tax system to put more money into the pockets of residents on lower to middle incomes, improving their ability to withstand the extra costs of living they face and making the island a more attractive proposition. So, this change aims to balance the age profile and make the island more appealing to younger individuals. And KPMG go on to propose offsetting these adjustments by tapering allowances for higher incomes and potentially increase the income tax rate. Quote, we would suggest that the government considers tapering away allowances and reliefs for taxpayers above a certain income threshold. In this way, the effective rate the taxpayer pays rises to the headline rate after tapering. There is a precedent for this approach in other tax competitive jurisdictions. Jersey reformed its tax system in 2000s, introducing a 20-20% principle for those on higher incomes, and Guernsey now also withdraws allowances from those on higher incomes. Although unpopular, KPMG believes a justified increase in taxes for higher income households, coupled with the island's benefits and competitive tax rates, it could be accepted as a way to fund necessary reforms. Quote again, while further research is advised, a moderate rebalancing of the personal tax system would appear unlikely to cause an exodus of high earners, assuming that those affected would still be substantially better off under a revised Isle of Man personal tax regime than in the UK and in a comparable to other Crown dependencies. So, honourable members, one has to question why this tax strategy is devoid of this information. Instead of following KPMG's advice to use a low tax regime to make the island attractive to individuals and businesses, this tax strategy recommends we agree to take the island's tax regime into the opposite direction. The tax strategy suggests suggestions presented in the KPMG 2022 report seem to have had little influence on the government development of the 2024 tax strategy. While KPMG's report emphasises the island's competitiveness and financial appeal, these crucial factors don't seem to have been considered by the Treasury's plans. Instead of addressing these fundamental issues, the government strategy focuses on generating more revenue through increasing taxes to maintain the current funding levels. Notably, the Treasury has chosen not to follow KPMG advice to raise the personal allowance, resulting in the 2024-25 allowance remaining the same as the 2022-23. Implementing this change in the recent budget could have been beneficial for individuals with low to middle incomes. But let's also look at the strategic objectives on page 4 of this strategy document. There are actually 6 objectives squeezed into 3 platitudes. In particular, I disagree with the term progressive tax system being used in this strategy. I do not see how this tax strategy is progressive. There is no bold statement to say that higher earners will pay more tax. The benefits of a progressive tax regime is that it is deliberate and comprehensive, not only to those less capable of paying it, but also on those more affluent. To achieve these objectives, there are many priority actions. I thought it was interesting to hear Deputy Chief Minister Mrs. Paul Wilson talk about business as usual earlier. Well, she's right. I would have expected majority of these new actions in this strategy were business as usual. Mr. President, most or are actually what I would hope the Treasury are doing as standard operating procedures or regular operations. And I agree that these are important, but really perhaps they should have been listed as business as usual so the reader could feel more comfortable.
After the break, Douglas North MHK David Ashford explains some of his concerns about the tax strategy and our island plan. David Ashford led a significant rebellion with his amendment, which would have seen the tax strategy being rejected, only narrowly defeated by one vote in the House of Keys. It's fair to say he wasn't particularly impressed with the tax strategy.
I think that's a bit of an underestimate, to be honest, Phil. It's an absolute damp squib, this tax strategy. All it does is it simply lays out what is currently going on. It doesn't give any direction of travel. From my point of view, it doesn't tie in with the economic strategy. It doesn't tie in with the Ireland plan. I said this during the Ireland plan debate as well. All these documents keep, say, referring to the other, but they don't actually lay out where they actually join up or actually give any metrics. It's, again, government at its worst and the fact it's not joined up.
And I think you identified that there were some contradictions in what the tax strategy says.
Well, there is. If you look at the actual table, the actual headline core objective is remain competitive. And then underneath it actually lists the different actions that will be taken. I've got to say, we're probably going to be the first jurisdiction in the world that says we're going to remain competitive by looking at different forms of tax and potentially increasing tax. That's a new strategy, a very brave one, I think, and not necessarily one that will work.
And Claire Christian referred to the KPMG report and pointed out that there were recommendations in there about tax. Are you surprised that there was no reference to that in the tax strategy?
I'm surprised and disappointed. I was actually Treasury Minister when the KPMG report was actually commissioned, and the whole purpose of that was to inform the tax strategy going forward. As I think was said by one member, it might have been Mrs. Christian or a previous speaker, actually turned around and said, we may as well not have spent the million, 2 million on KPMG if we were just going to go off and do what we wanted anyway. And that's what seems to have happened. There's no reference back to that. There's no reference saying this is what we're going to do. The KPMG report was very, very clear that if we were going to drive things forward, we needed to be competitive for those low to middle income families and put money back in their pocket. And we're not doing that. And the tax strategy is showing no strategy for doing that either.
This isn't sour grapes. I used to be the Treasury Minister and now I'm not. And the new Treasury Minister's tax strategy is a load of nonsense.
Most certainly not. I mean, I haven't been Treasury Minister now for 2 years. I deliberately, for the first 12 months, remained quite quiet around things. If people go back and check, because you don't want this whole thing about is he a backseat driver or even trying to be a front seat driver. But I have a duty to support my constituents. And when I believe something is wrong as an elected member, I should be calling it out. My budget speech was well balanced and I voted for the budget despite my reservations on certain aspects, particularly tax. But this tax strategy is absolutely meaningless and I wouldn't be actually being true to myself or to my constituents if I sat here and voted for something that I do not believe is going to actually lead this island forward or improve the situation.
Okay, then. So what what should be in the tax strategy, do you think? I mean, what are, you know, a couple of highlights that you would have liked to have seen?
So a couple of highlights I'd like to have seen in the tax strategy, is it linking back to the economic plan? Saying this is the evidence we've had from KPMG, so this is the route of travel that we need to take there. So take a prime example, one of the things that's actually stated in the tax strategy is when fiscal conditions allow, actually basically providing support for low and middle income families and reducing their tax burden, which this budget made worse. Well, what fiscal conditions? There is nothing anywhere in that document that says what those fiscal conditions will be. It seems to be completely subjective to whoever happens to be Treasury Minister at the time. A bit like Gordon Brown's Euro tests, if anyone remembers them from the late 90s. So what I'd like to see is very clear direction of travel that says if X, Y and Z happens, then we will look to do this. If it doesn't happen, this is the alternative. But what it does is it's couched in very vague language and it opens up the possibility to pretty much anything. I think far from restoring confidence both amongst the public and business community, this tax strategy will leave more questions unanswered for them.
One of the parts of your amendment is looking for an awful lot more detail than there is in the tax strategy. But do you, as a former Treasury Minister and as an experienced politician, do you not see that it's not always easy for Treasury Ministers to put a lot of detail in about what potential tax rates of the future might be?
Well, what I'm not asking for is to list out the budgets for the next 5 years. What I clearly state in my amendment is what I'm looking for is how it interacts with the economic plan and the island plan. So I'm not saying come forward and tell us what's in the 25 budget, 26 budget now. What I'm saying is, right, you've got the economic strategy, you've got the island plan, you've got this KPMG report, link back and show us metrics as to how you are delivering the things that Tim Wood has already said and approved that we need to actually deliver. That's what I'm asking for, a proper rate of metrics, not turning around, for instance, and saying we will comply with international tax standards. That's not an option. That's not a we might or we might not. We either do it or we get blacklisted, let's be honest. But that's down as an objective. It's not an objective.
Treasury Minister, interestingly enough, said, well, it is an option. We could choose not to comply with international tax strategy, but it would be a strange thing to do. You referenced there the Our Island Plan update, and whilst you didn't join the 25% of the House of Keys that voted against, you didn't entirely speak in favour.
No, I had concerns in the fact that, again, I'm not sure. You know, it says what the targets are, reiterates what the direction of travel needs to be, but I'm still not certain on how we're actually getting there. So the population forecast, you know, the 100,000 and so on, there's still nothing there that actually firmly says this is how we're going to achieve that. But as I pointed out, we're looking, that means with 8 years to go, a population growth that that's equal to what we've seen over the last 35 years. And also there's nothing really there about a strategic infrastructure needs assessment, because surely government isn't saying we're going to grow that population in that short period of time. We're not going to need more doctors, we're not going to need more hospital support, we're not going to need more dentists, we're not going to need improved highways, we're not even maybe going to need additional water infrastructure or electricity infrastructure. All of that needs to be done as well. You know, if we're going to just say, right, we'll just add to the population and worry about it later, then that really does concern me.
And I suppose then in the reference to tax in all of this, I mean, the idea is an increase in the economically active population helps pay for various services. But presumably that increased population, as you've just alluded to, will ultimately need services. So this is a short-term fix.
They will, and what happens is, in order to provide that, you do have to front load it. We have to accept that you have to be developing those services now, because they take lead in time. So for instance, the development, say if you need new GP services or expanded GP services, that takes time. It's not instant. So that's why you need to front load and be leading towards that now, if you've got confidence you are going to grow the population. But equally, we need more support for businesses as well at the front end. I'm still hearing from businesses how much of a struggle it is out there, particularly in several sectors, including retail and hospitality. And I'll be frank, they don't feel they're being listened to. They feel their genuine concerns of what they are living day in, day out are being dismissed.
And it would appear that as yet you haven't joined the rebel alliance, which seems to be developing in Tynwald. Have you had thoughts in that direction?
Well, I'm not that much of a Star Wars fan, but no, I haven't been asked to join any alliance. You know, my allegiance is to the voters of Douglas North, who put me here in the first place, and the Isle of Man, people of the Isle of Man as a whole, who I feel I'm represented as an All Ireland MHK as well. I think when you're elected as an MHK, you're there to represent everyone. So my allegiance is to that. So I'm not sure if they've got a clubhouse or a club badge, this new alliance, but no, I'm certainly not part of any wider team. I made quite clear to the electorate I'm there to listen to them and then make my own decisions. I've never joined any former group and I have no intention of doing so.
There does, though, seem to be an increasing disquiet in House of Keys, particularly. I mean, Legislative Council seems to vote on block for whatever government puts forward, but for the House of Keys, there does seem to be quite a disgruntlement amongst members.
I think it's because members in some cases don't feel that things are progressing or they're not being listened to, and we're continuing down the same line despite the concerns being expressed. As Einstein said, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. And so there will be frustrations that I think are beginning to emerge. But the important thing with any frustration is that you come forward in a constructive manner. I could have sat here today and just voted against the tax strategy and receiving it. Instead, I've decided to try and bring forward an amendment. Whether that amendment will pass or not, time will tell. Probably we'll know by the time people are listening to this. But I think that's a more constructive way to operate. But obviously, if the amendment fails, then I'm likely to vote against.
The rebel alliance referred to was referenced in Tynwald by the Chief Minister and included sacked ministers Edge and Thomas alongside Claire Christian. You may also have heard Tanya August Hansen, MLC, heckling my suggestion that LegCo voting appears to follow the government line. While it is true that occasionally LegCo members stray from that party line, more often than not they appear to comply with government's wishes, apparently because these make more sense than the alternatives. One area that LegCo might have reasonably shown leadership was the debate on the Boundary Commission recommendations into the future size of constituencies and conduct of elections. These recommendations were relatively modest when compared with the significant changes recommended by the Commission's predecessor and supported by Tynwald back in 2013, which saw the replacement of long-standing constituencies with equal-sized two-seat constituencies. I was quite surprised then that only two MHKs voted to support Keys constituency sizes remaining in line with internationally accepted standards. Cabinet Office member Diane Kelsey moved the debate.
In moving the Electoral Commission's January 2024 report, my role is to act as the conduit to enable the report, its findings and recommendations to be debated by this Honourable Court today. So what's the background to this report? Well, the work of the Isle of Man's first ever Electoral Commission follows on from the previously appointed Boundary Review Committee, who reported several times to Tynwald between 2011 and 2013. It was the recommendations of that committee which led to the current 12 equal constituencies being established, each with two MHKs. Coming up to date, and in accordance with Section 57 of the Elections, brackets, Keys and Local Authorities Act 2020, an electoral commission had to be appointed by the Governor in Council within 12 months of the 2021 general election. The Electoral Commission is an independent body was tasked to review the following: our current constituencies and their boundaries, the number of members per constituency, and whether population should be the sole guide to constituency size. At our sitting on the 20th July 2022, and following feedback from those involved in the last general election, including CPA Commonwealth Parliamentary Association observers, the Minister for the Cabinet Office moved that the Commission also consider a number of issues concerning the administration of elections. Following the debate and an amendment from the Honourable Member for Rushen, Mr Speaker, we agreed that, and I will quote, in addition to reviewing the number of boundaries of number and boundaries of constituencies, which will include the number of seats per constituency, the Electoral Commission must consider and produce a report to Tynwald on the following matters: accessibility of elections to voters, organisation of pre-election meetings, the postal voting procedures and proxy voting procedures, the ability to vote at any polling station across a constituency, the feasibility of setting up one or more all-island polling stations, candidate campaign materials, and in doing so, they shall have due regard for the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association benchmarks for democratic legislatures and the potential costs of those recommendations. The Electoral Commission were tasked by us to report their findings and recommendations within 18 months of their appointment. And this is the report laid before us for debate and receiving it today, with its 13 recommendations as laid out on our order paper at item 5. I'd like to thank the Commission on behalf of this Honourable Court for its hard work over the period. Their work plays a vital part in our democratic process.
Garth MHK Andrew Smith raised concerns that community identity should not be undermined by boundary changes.
I think sometimes that we jump too quickly to embrace outside influences. And I think as an island population of 227 square miles, 85, ostracising people. And from my perspective within Garth, obviously, I've canvassed for two general elections now. The first one, obviously, I wasn't successful. The second one, I was, 2016-2021. And on the doorstep, there are people that are vehemently, and I mean that, they shut the door in your face, vehemently opposed to voting within the election because they were one. And they had no relationship with Garth. I mean, with Elonkin, you've got a vibrant town there with a well-populated high street of businesses. You know, no empty shops particularly. You've got the churches, public houses, restaurants, pharmacy, filling station, Onken Associating Football Club. You've got community groups. Is that not is that not the epitome of community?
And yet, what the Commission will say, the Boundary Commission will say, is there are international standards. And if the Isle of Man wishes to meet those international standards, then, quite frankly, part of that is ensuring that constituencies are generally within a reasonable margin, similar sized.
Yeah, well, I'm all for meeting international standards. But again, you know, on the Isle of Man, are you suggesting to me that an MHK in a particular area is really worried if he may have a few more constituents to look after than another? I mean, already we have those MHKs who are in densely populated areas, so they've got a mass population within a contained area. Where have you got people like Aaron Michael and Garth, where we've got much more people spread out along the whole, around the constituency? So, again, international standards fine, but really view those in relation to the Isle of Man, which is where we live, which is where the people are, where the people wish to be served, and if they believe that they are getting the best benefit from the service of their elected representative, then is that a big issue?
So, from your perspective, and I know other MHKs share this view, community integrity is as important, if not more important, than meeting those international standards.
Yeah, and inclusivity. A lot of people feel ostracised You know, and as I say, if we then put something in place because we're meeting some out with the island body to satisfy something that may be relevant to Tokyo or Hong Kong or whatever it may be, then we are, as I say, ostracising people, and then we're doing the exact opposite to what wishing to engage them in what we want to see as a democratic process fit for purpose for the Isle of Man in the 21st century.
Fellow Garth MHK Daphne Kane recognised the Onkin community concern, but was one of the few speakers that acknowledged that the two-seat constituencies of equal size were working reasonably well.
Unusually for me, I am in a quandary on the first three recommendations. My instinct was to support the Commission, which has diligently looked into all elements of our election procedure. And yet, I am aware there are several residents in Onkin who do not feel part of Garth, even after 7.5 years. And they continue to refuse to vote until we return them to Onkin for national elections. My dilemma is that over the last 7.5 years, I have supported and worked on a large number of constituents residing in Groudle, in Abbeylands, Majestic area, Lakeside. Probably a good third of my constituency queries come from constituents resident outside of the traditional Garth of Lonnon and Macleod. Like my honourable colleague, Mr. Smith, I do not want to convey any lack of support for those residents or suggested rejection, and I will continue to represent them, even if this Honourable Court determines to return them to the Onkin Keys constituency. I also had contact from a couple of residents in South Ramsey who would happily have become part of the Garth Keys constituency. and like the Chief Minister, I like a pick and mix, and I think we are all one island. We are one constituency, and just defining boundaries for a national election. While I have huge sympathy for those who are not happy with boundary changes, I have to support the work and conclusions of the committee. Why, I wonder, do members feel the interests of urban voters will differ from rural communities? We are one united island. Just let's divide equally into constituencies. I fear that if we go against the principle of equality and equivalency of representation, we will reduce the democratic representation. Whichever way this goes, I believe we're going to have to revisit it, and it will be a constantly thorny issue. Onkin is a great community. So is Laxey, so is Macleod, so is Abbeylands, so is Ramsey. But the island is, we have communities within communities. Why is it so difficult to find a system that works? I feel that what we've had in the 12 two-seat constituencies has served us well.
An attempt was made by Onkin MHK Rob Colliser to reunify Onkin, and his amendment was narrowly defeated 13-10 in the House of Keys.
You were one of several MHKs, in fact the vast majority, who decided that the Isle of Man shouldn't meet international standards when it comes to the size of your constituency. Why did you do that?
Well, the Electoral Commission published its report. I wasn't happy with recommendation 1, 2 or 3, which did relate to international standards around the size of constituency, the number of MHKs that are represented within those constituencies. For me personally, I felt the decision taken in June 2013 to break up my constituency of Onkin into 3 different constituency was completely the wrong decision. And I've had to wait almost, 10 years to be given a fair opportunity to put forward an amendment in order to try and bring the constituency and the community of Onkin back together as a single community and as a single constituency for both the House of Keys and for the local authority elections.
It is fair to say that the debate lacked any real steer certainly from the government side. You might have thought that there would have been a steer, bearing in mind this is a committee, or a commission, I should say, that's established to try and come up with a fair way of ensuring fair representation, following the principles set by Tynwald for this commission. Is it right that MHKs should be effectively interfering with what their constituencies should look like?
I think the Speaker of the House of Keys made a very valid point. When you have somewhere like the Isle of Wight and another constituency within the UK that has almost a difference of 100,000 people, but they're still only represented by one MP in each constituency. And what I'm trying to say is that the Isle of Man, we've got to respect historic constituency boundaries. Now, I absolutely supported the principle of two MHKs in all constituencies. But what I actually said was it was absolutely right and proper for Onchan to be brought back together following the local authority boundary map in order to allow all of the residents within Onchan to vote for two members in the House of Keys in the future. Unfortunately, that amendment of mine narrowly was defeated, 13 votes to 10 in the House of Keys and 1 and 7 in the Legislative Council. But what has actually happened is the actual Tynwald Court has now voted out Recommendation 1, Recommendation 3. And we may have a situation now where all of this gets reviewed again. So we may end up finding in the future that we actually go back to the old system where we have a combination of 1, 2, and 3 MHKs. All I was asking for is to put back Onchan exactly how it was prior to 2013 and the House of Keys election that was held in 2016.
If we go back far enough, though, each sheading in the Isle of Man elected 3 members of the House of Keys. So that would be 3 for Rushen, 3 for Onchan, 3 for Garth, which was the one, Glenfaber and Michael. Was it Michael, the other one? Anyway, how far back do we need to go in time when you're looking at these things? And surely we have to accept that, the Isle of Man changes. There are different numbers of people living in different places, and somehow that has to be reflected when it comes to constituency sizes.
I think if you actually look at this, putting two constituencies together, two local authority areas together, is fine. We're breaking up historic boundaries. And we have to remember, if we go back in time, as you've just mentioned, to 1985, Onchan, the rural part of Onchan, actually had a referendum. The last time the island held a referendum. And in that referendum, they agreed to join the village of Onchan. And it became a single constituency, a single community. And then come along the commission in 2013 and broke that up again, just for the House of Keys. And it's very confusing because you ask every single resident of Onchan to come together to vote for their local authority representatives. But when it comes to the House of Keys, they then have to make a different choice. You may get a say in your Onchan MHK, but there is 2,200 in the village, and there's a further 72 that's been placed in Douglas North, which now vote either in Garth for the House of Keys, or they vote in Douglas North for the House of Keys election. That, to me, is just not right. And we should be able to put Onchan back together, either have 2 MHKs or 3 to represent the whole of the village and the whole of the parish and the community collectively.
What about, because of course the other thing that the Commission can, I think, look at, although I don't think it was specifically within the remit, is constituency size. You've alluded to it there, but surely what we have to have is constituencies that are the same size in terms of numbers of representation. And would the obvious thing, certainly in Onchan's case, would be just to put Onchan back together again and create a 4-seat constituency, including Garth. The South would have a 4-seat constituency for the whole of the South, and so on and so forth. Is that something that would appeal to you?
I think the constituency size is a very important point. Now, it does have a factor of 15% either side. Now, we know from the census data that Douglas and Onchan, the population is decreasing. Now, if you take the latest report from the Commission, it actually said that Onchan's at the moment, from a constituency point of view, is represented around about 95%. So in theory, the Commission could have brought forward a recommendation to put anything up to 20% of those rural voters that vote either in Douglas North or in Garth back into Onchan. And they never took the opportunity. And for me personally, that is where the Commission's gone wrong in respect to Recommendation 1, in Recommendation 2, and in respect to Recommendation 3. They could have taken the opportunity to put some people back into Onchan to repair some of the damage that's been done in 2013, because there is a lot of outcry within the village and the parish of Onchan that said that they want to be represented by an MHK which has Onchan next to the name.
So in essence, the result of the vote in Tynwald is that the status quo is pretty much retained. I mean, there were a few recommendations that did manage to survive, a few amended recommendations got through. But in essence, the constituency size remains the same, and there's no clarity that there has to be any further investigation.
No, there isn't. And that, to me, Tynwald did turn down recommendation 1, 2, and 3. It is now for the Cabinet Office and for the Commission to look at the Tynwald debate and to see if they need to bring forward a further report before the House of Keys general election in 2026. If we go back to 2011, when the Commission was first set up, they end up bringing three reports before the court before they actually got the final conclusions through. So I can see again the Commission having to bring forward a further report which has further consideration in respect of the comments made, not just by myself on behalf of the people of Onchan, but also, you know, in Aaron Michael, in Ramsey. There is a lot of concern about this report. It needs to be carefully looked through. Yes, we do respect international standards, but we also have to respect our communities.
If I was a member of the Commission, or indeed a politician in the Cabinet Office, I would probably look at the Hansard for the debate and think, don't touch this with a barge pole, because members didn't have a collective view. It's fair to say there were lots of views expressed, but there was very little coalescence around a single theme.
I think this is typical of the way our parliament works. Normally, when you narrow something down that it affects, say, for example, likes, it really does seriously affect the people of Onchan. The representatives in Douglas don't really care, and the wider MHKs in the court don't care either. So this is really hard when you are trying to convince your colleagues to change hearts and minds to support you. And as I say, I managed to convince 10 members in the House of Keys, which was fantastic. We're only just short of the total number that I needed. So I will look to see what the Commission brings forward. And I am still going to keep fighting to bring Onchan back together as a single constituency for future House of Keys elections.
Rob Collister had support from Speaker of the House of Keys, Ewan Watterson.
Best practice should not be blind to community. So I do support the amendment in the name of Mr. Collister, bringing Onchan back together and treating it as a whole. It should be remembered that whatever is said about the 5% rule, as was said by the Boundary Commission, that applies in England, there is flexibility. And in the same Parliament, in the same House of Commons, the Isle of Wight has 113,000 voters and Arfon in Wales has just 42,000 voters. Both get just one seat in the Commons, one seat, one vote. So it goes to show that community distinctions do have significant weight, and I'm glad that that's going to be recommended in recommendations 1 to 3.
And a final word from Chris Thomas, who explains the reason for some of the exceptions referred to by Mr. Speaker.
I think we heard that most of the very wide-ranging population size constituencies were islands. So I wondered whether the argument was being made that Ramsey would be an island one day after flood risk wasn't managed properly, or Onchan already was an island, or whether it comes down to them being sparsely populated minorities, which is another thing, or is it just the identity issue? And on that basis, I will remind people in Onchan that they used to be part of Glenfeibre. It was before 1796, but I hear they still talk about it in those parts.
So what do you think? Was the tax strategy worth the effort? Should more be done, or is this an unnecessary distraction from the real work of government? And Keys boundaries? Should they follow the fairly bold ambition set out in 2013 to ensure equality of representation?
Or is community identity more important? Should we go back to the old system with 1, 2 and 3 seat constituencies? What would encourage you to vote? Constituency sizes and ease of voting, or policies and actual delivery? Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast on Manx Radio's website. I'm Phil Gorn. Goramayos an geishachrom. Thanks for listening.